Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Part the First, Chapter 14 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 14. Ashore. Thus, after a voyage of 74 days, the Pilgrim had stranded. Mrs. Weldon and her fellow voyagers joined in thanksgiving to the kind providence that had brought them ashore, not upon one of the solitary islands of Polynesia, but upon a solid continent, from almost any part of which there would be no difficulty in getting home. The ship was totally lost. She was lying in the surf, a hopeless wreck, and few must be the hours that would elapse before she would be broken up in scattered fragments. It was impossible to save her. Notwithstanding that Dick Sands bewailed the loss of a valuable ship and her cargo to the owner, he had the satisfaction of knowing that he had been instrumental in saving what was far more precious, the lives of the owner's wife and son. It was impossible to do more than hazard a conjecture as to the part of the South American coast on which the Pilgrim had been cast. Dick imagined that it must be somewhere on the coast of Peru. After sighting Easter Island, he knew that the united action of the equatorial current and the brisk wind must have had the effect of driving the schooner far northward, and he formed his conclusion accordingly. Be the true position, however, what it might, it was all important that it should be accurately ascertained as soon as possible. If it were really in Peru, he would not be long in finding his way to one of the numerous ports and villages that lie along the coast. But the shore here was quite a desert. A narrow strip of beach, strewn with boulders, was enclosed by a cliff of no great height, in which, at irregular intervals, deep funnels appeared as chasms in the rock. Here and there a gentle slope led to the top. About a quarter of a mile to the north was the mouth of a little river which had not been visible from the sea. Its banks were overhung by a number of rhizophora, a species of mangrove entirely distinct from that indigenous to India. It was soon ascertained that the summit of the cliff was clothed by a dense forest, extending far away in undulations of verdure to the mountains in the background. Had Cousin Benedict been a botanist, he could not have failed to find a new and interesting field for his researches. They were lofty baobabs, to which an extraordinary longevity has often been erroneously ascribed, with bark resembling Egyptian syenite. There were white pines, tamarinds, pepper plants of peculiar species, and numerous other plants unfamiliar to the eye of a native of the north. But strange to say, there was not a single specimen of the extensive family of palms, of which more than 1,000 varieties are scattered in profusion in so many quarters of the globe. Above the shore hovered a large number of screeching birds, mostly of the swallow tribe, their black plumage shot with steely blue, and shading off to a light brown at the top of the head. Now and then a few partridges of a greyish color rose on wing, their necks entirely bare of feathers. The fearless manner in which the various birds all allowed themselves to be approached made Mrs. Weldon and Dick both wonder if the shores upon which they had been thrown were not so deserted that the sound of firearms was not known. On the edge of the reefs, some pelicans, of the species known as Pelicanus minor, were busily filling their pouches with tiny fish, and some gulls coming in from the open sea began to circle round the wreck. With these exceptions, not a living creature appeared in sight. Benedict, no doubt, could have discovered many entomological novelties among the foliage, but these could give no more information than the birds as to the name of their habitat. Neither north, nor south, nor towards the forest, was there trace of rising smoke, or any footprint or other sign to indicate the presence of a human being. Dick's surprise was very great. He knew that the proximity of a native would have made Dingo bark aloud, but the dog gave no warning. He was running backwards and forwards, his tail lowered, and his nose close to the ground. Now and again he uttered a deep growl. "Look at Dingo," said Mrs. Weldon. "How strange he is. He seems to be trying to discover a lost scent." After watching the dog for a time, she spoke again. "Look, too, at Negoro. He and the dog seem to be on the same purpose." "As to Negoro," said Dick, "I cannot concern myself with him now. He must do as he pleases. I have no further control over him. His service expires with the loss of the ship." Negoro was in fact walking to and fro, surveying the shore with the air of a man who was trying to recall some past experience to his recollection. His dog taciturnity was too well known for anyone to think of questioning him. Everyone was accustomed to let him go his own way, and when Dick noticed that he had gone towards the little river and had disappeared behind the cliff, he thought no more about him. Dingo likewise had quite forgotten his enemy and desisted from his growling. The first necessity for the shipwrecked party was to find a temporary shelter, where they might take some refreshment. There was no lack of provisions. Independently of the resources of the land, the ebbing tide had left upon the rocks the great bulk of the pilgrim's stores, and the negroes had already collected several kegs of biscuit and a number of cases of preserved meat, besides a variety of other supplies. All that they rescued they carefully piled up above the high water mark. As nothing appeared to be injured by the sea water, the victualling of the party all seemed to be satisfactorily secure for the interval which must elapse, and they all believed it would not be long before they reached one of the villages which they presumed were close at hand. Dick, moreover, took the precaution of sending Hercules to get a small supply of fresh water from the river hard by, and the good-natured fellow returned carrying a whole barrel full on his shoulder. Plenty of fuel was lying about, and whenever they wanted to light a fire, they were sure of having an abundance of dead wood and the roots of the old mangroves. Old Tom, an inveterate smoker, always carried a tinder box in his pocket. This had been too tightly fastened to be affected by the moisture, and could always produce a spark upon occasion. Still, they must have a shelter. Without some rest, it was impossible to start upon a tour of exploration. Accordingly, all interests were directed towards ascertaining where the necessary repose could be obtained. The honor of discovering where the desired retreat could be found fell to the lot of Little Jack. Trotting about at the foot of the cliff, he came upon one of those grottos which are constantly being found hollowed out in the rock by the vehement action of the waves in time of tempest. "Here, look here!" cried the child. "Here is a place!" "Well done, Jack," answered his mother. "Your lucky discovery is just what we wanted. If we were going to stay here any time, we should have to do the same as the Swiss Family Robinson and name the spot after you." It was hardly more than 12 or 14 feet square, and yet the grotto seemed to Jack to be a gigantic cavern. But narrow as its limits were, it was capacious enough to receive the entire party. It was a great satisfaction to Mrs. Weldon to observe that it was perfectly dry, and as the moon was just about her first quarter, there was no likelihood of a tide rising to the foot of the cliff. At any rate, it was resolved that they might take up their quarters there for a few hours. Shortly after 1 o'clock, the whole party were seated upon a carpet of seaweed round a repast consisting of preserved meat, biscuit, and water flavored with a few drops of rum, of which Bat had saved a quart bottle from the wreck. Even Negoro had returned and joined the group. Probably he had not cared to venture alone along the bank of the stream into the forest. He sat listening, as it seemed indifferently, to the various plans for the future that were being discussed, and did not open his mouth either way of remonstrance or suggestion. Dingo was not forgotten, and had his share of food duly given him outside the grotto, where he was keeping guard. When the meal was ended, Mrs. Weldon, passing her arms around Jack, who was lounging half asleep with excitement and fatigue at her side, was the first to speak. "My dear Dick," she said, "in the name of us all, let me thank you for the services you have rendered us in our tedious time of difficulty. As you have been our captain at sea, let me beg you to be our guide upon land. We shall have perfect confidence in your judgment, and await your instructions as to what our next proceedings shall be." All eyes were turned upon Dick. Even Negoro appeared to be roused to curiosity, as if eager to know what he had to say. Dick did not speak for some moments. He was manifestly pondering what step he should advise. After a while he said, "My own impression, Mrs. Weldon, is that we have been cast ashore upon one of the least frequented parts of the coast of Peru, and that we are near the borders of the Pampas. In that case I should conclude that we are at a considerable distance from any village. Now, I recommend that we stay here altogether for the coming night. Tomorrow morning two of us can start off on an exploring expedition. I entertain but little doubt that natives will be met with within 10 or 12 miles. Mrs. Weldon looked doubtful. Plainly she thought unfavorably of the project of separating the party. She reflected for a considerable time and then asked, "And who is to undertake the task of exploring?" Prompt was Dick's answer, "Tom and I." "And leave us here?" suggested the lady. "Yes, to take care of you, there will be Hercules, Bat, Actaeon, and Austin." "Negoro, too, I presume, means to be reigned here," said Dick, glancing towards the cook. "Perhaps," replied Negoro, sparing as ever of his words. "We shall take Dingo," added Dick. "Likely enough he may be useful." At the sound of his name, the dog had entered the grotto. A short bark seemed to testify his approval of Dick's proposal. Mrs. Weldon was silent. She looked sad and thoughtful. It was hard to reconcile herself to the division of the party. She was aware that the separation would not be for long, but she could not suppress a certain feeling of nervousness. Was it not possible that some natives, attracted by the wreck, would assault them in hopes of plunder? Every argument he could think of, Dick brought forward to reassure the lady. He told her that the Indians were perfectly harmless, and entirely different to the savage tribes of Africa and Polynesia. There was no reason to apprehend any mischief, even if they should chance to encounter them, which was itself extremely unlikely. No doubt the separation would have its inconveniences, but they would be insignificant compared with the difficulty of traversing the country en masse. Tom and he would have far greater freedom if they went alone, and could make their investigations much more thoroughly. Finally, he promised that if within 2 days they failed to discover human habitation, they would return to the grotto forthwith. "I confess, however," he added, "that I have little expectation of being able to ascertain our true position until I have penetrated some distance into the country." There was nothing in Dick's representations but what commanded Mrs. Weldon's assent as reasonable. It was simply her own nervousness, she acknowledged, that made her hesitate, but it was only with extreme reluctance that she finally yielded to the proposition. "And what, Mr. Benedict, is your opinion of my proposal?" said Dick, turning to the entomologist. "I," answered Cousin Benedict, looking somewhat bewildered. "Oh, I am agreeable to anything. I dare say I shall find some specimens. I think I will go and look at once." "Take my advice, and don't go far away," replied Dick. "All right, I shall take care of myself." "And don't be bringing back a lot of mosquitoes," said old Tom mischievously. With his box under his arm, the naturalist left the grotto. Negoro followed almost immediately. He did not take the same direction as Benedict up the cliff, but for the second time bent his steps towards the river, and proceeded along its bank till he was out of sight. It was not long before Jack's exertions told upon him, and he fell into a sound sleep. Mrs. Weldon, having gently laid him on Nan's lap, wandered out and made her way to the water's edge. She was soon joined by Dick and the negroes, who wanted to see whether it was possible to get to the Pilgrim, and secure any articles that might be serviceable for future use. The reef on which the schooner had stranded was now quite dry, and the carcass of the vessel, which had been partially covered at high water, was lying in the midst of debris of the most promiscuous character. The wide difference between high and low water mark caused Dick Sands no little surprise. He knew that the tides on the shores of the Pacific were very inconsiderable. In his own mind, however, he came to the conclusion that the phenomenon was to be explained by the unusually high wind that had been blowing on the coast. Not without emotion could Mrs. Weldon, or indeed any of them, behold the unfortunate ship upon which they had spent so many eventful days, lying dismasted on her side. But there was little time for sentiment. If they wished to visit the hull before it finally went to pieces, there must be no delay. Hoisting themselves by some loose rigging that was hanging from the deck, Dick and several of the negroes contrived to make their way into the interior of the hull. Dick left his men to gather together all they could in the way of food and drink from the storeroom, and himself went straight to the stern cabin, into which the water had not penetrated. Here he found 4 excellent Purday's Remington rifles and 100 cartridges. With these he determined to arm his party, in case they should be attacked by Indians. He also chose 6 of the strongest of the cutlasses that are used for slicing up dead whales, and did not forget the little toy gun which was Jack's special property. Unexpectedly he found a pocket compass, which he was only too glad to appropriate. What a boon it would have been had he discovered it earlier. The ship's charts in the fore cabin were too much injured by water to be of any further service. Nearly everything was either lost or spoiled, but the misfortune was not felt very acutely because there was ample provision for a few days, and it seemed useless to burden themselves with more than was necessary. Dick hardly needed Mrs. Weldon's advice to secure all the money that might be on board, but after the most diligent search he failed to discover more than $500. This was a subject of perplexity. Mrs. Weldon had had a considerably larger sum than this, and Captain Hall was known always to keep a good reserve in hand. There was but one way to solve the mystery. Someone had been beforehand to the wreck. It could not be of any of the negroes, and not one of them had had for a moment left the grotto. Suspicion naturally fell upon Negoro, who had been out alone upon the shore. Morose and cold-blooded as the man was, Dick hardly knew why he should suspect him of the crime of theft. Nevertheless, he determined to cross-examine him, and if need be, to have him searched as soon as he came back. The day wore onwards to its close. The sun was approaching the vernal equinox, and sank almost perpendicularly onto the horizon. Twilight was very short, and the rapidity with which darkness came on confirmed Dick in his belief that they had got ashore at some spot lying between the Tropic of Capricorn and the equator. They all assembled in the grotto again for the purpose of getting some sleep. "Another rough night coming on," said Tom, pointing to the heavy clouds that hung over the horizon. "No doubt, Tom," answered Dick, "and I think we may congratulate ourselves on being safe out of our poor ship." As the night could not be otherwise than very dark, it was arranged that the negroes should take their turns in keeping guard at the entrance of the grotto. Dingo also would be upon the alert. Benedict had not yet returned. Hercules shouted his name with the full strength of his capacious lungs, and shortly afterwards the entomologist was seen making his way down the face of the cliff, at the imminent risk of breaking his neck. He was in a great rage. He had not found a single insect worth having. Scorpions, scolopendra, and other myriapoda were in the forest in abundance, but not one of these, of course, could be allowed a place in his collection. "Have I come 6,000 miles for this?" he cried. "Have I endured storm and shipwreck only to be cast where not a hexapod is to be seen? The country is detestable. I shall not stay in it another hour." Ever gentle to his eccentricities, Mrs. Weldon soothed him as she would a child. She told him that he had better take some rest now, and most likely he would have better luck tomorrow. Cousin Benedict had hardly been pacified when Tom remarked that Negoro too had not returned. "Never mind," said Bat, "his room is as good as his company." "I cannot say that I altogether think so. The man is no favourite of mine, but I like him better under my own eye," said Mrs. Weldon. "Perhaps he has his own reasons for keeping away," said Dick, and taking Mrs. Weldon aside, he communicated to her his suspicions of the fellow's dishonesty. He found that she coincided with him in her view of Negoro's conduct, but she did not agree with him in his proposal to have him searched at once. If he returned, she should be convinced that he had deposited the money in some secret spot, and as there would be no proof of his guilt, it would be better to leave him, at least for a time, uninterrogated. Dick was convinced by her representations, and promised to act upon her advice. Before they resigned themselves to sleep, they had repeatedly summoned Negoro back, but he either could not or would not hear. Mrs. Weldon and Dick scarcely knew what to think, unless he had lost his way. It was unaccountable why he should be wandering about alone on a dark night in a strange country. Presently Dingo was heard barking furiously. He had left the opening of the grotto and was evidently down at the water's edge. Imagining that Negoro must be coming, Dick sent three of the negroes in the direction of the river to meet him, but when they reached the bank not a soul could be seen, and as Dingo was quiet again, they made their way back to the grotto. Excepting the man left on watch, they now all lay down, hoping to get some repose. Mrs. Weldon, however, could not sleep. The land for which she had sighted so ardently had been reached, but it had failed to give either the security or the comfort which she had anticipated. End of Part the First, Chapter 14. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. www.alexctalander.com. Part the First, Chapter 15 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 15. A Stranger. At daybreak next morning, Austin, who had happened to be on guard, heard Dingo bark, and noticed that he started up and ran towards the river. Arousing the inmates of the grotto, he announced to them that someone was coming. "It isn't Negoro," said Tom. "Dingo would bark louder than that if Negoro were to be seen." "Who then can it be?" asked Mrs. Weldon, with an inquiring glance towards Dick. "We must wait and see, madam," replied Dick quietly. Bidding Bat, Austin, and Hercules follow his example, Dick Sands took up a cutlass and a rifle, into the breech of which he slipped a cartridge. Thus armed, the four young men made their way towards the river bank. Tom and Actaeon were left with Mrs. Weldon at the entrance of the grotto. The sun was just rising. Its rays, intercepted by the lofty range of mountains in the east, did not fall directly on the cliff, but the sea to its western horizon was sparkling in the sunbeams as the party marched along the shore. Dingo was motionless as a setter, but did not cease barking. It soon proved not to be his old enemy who was disturbing him. A man who was not Negoro appeared round the angle of the cliff, and advancing cautiously along the bank of the stream, seemed by his gestures to be endeavouring to pacify the dog, with which an encounter would certainly have been by no means desirable. "That's not Negoro," said Hercules. "No loss for any of us," muttered Bat. "You are right," replied Dick. "Perhaps he is a native. Let us hope he may be able to tell us our whereabouts, and save us the trouble of exploring." With their rifles on their shoulders, they advanced steadily towards the new arrival. The stranger, on becoming aware of their approach, manifested great surprise. He was apparently puzzled as to how they had reached the shore, for the pilgrim had been entirely broken up during the night, and the spars that were floating about had probably been too few and too scattered to attract his attention. His first attitude seemed to betray something of fear, and raising to his shoulder a gun that had been slung to his belt, he began to retrace his steps. But conciliatory gestures on the part of Dick quickly reassured him, and after a moment's hesitation, he continued to advance. He was a man of about 40 years of age, strongly built, with a keen, bright eye, grizzly hair and beard, and a complexion tanned as with constant exposure to the forest air. He wore a broad-brimmed hat, a kind of leather jerkin or tunic, and long boots reaching nearly to his knees. To his high heels was fastened a pair of wide-rowelled spurs, which clanked as he moved. Dick Sands in an instant saw that he was not looking upon one of the roving Indians of the Pampas, but upon one of those adventurers, often a very doubtful character, who are not unfrequently to be met with in the remotest quarters of the earth. Clearly this was neither an Indian nor a Spaniard. His erect, not to say rigid deportment, and the reddish hue with which his hair and beard were streaked, betokened him to be of Anglo-Saxon origin, a conjecture which was at once confirmed when upon Dick's wishing him good morning, he replied in unmistakable English, with hardly a trace of foreign accent. "Good morning, my young friend." He stepped forward, and having shaken hands with Dick, nodded to all his companions. "Are you English?" he asked. "No, we are Americans," replied Dick. "North or south?" inquired the man. "North," Dick answered. The information seemed to afford the stranger no little satisfaction, and he again wrung Dick's hand with all the enthusiasm of a fellow countryman. "And may I ask what brings you here?" he continued. Before, however, Dick had time to reply, the stranger had courteously raised his hat, and looking round, Dick saw that his bow was intended for Mrs. Weldon, who had just reached the river bank. She proceeded to tell him the particulars of how they had been shipwrecked, and how the vessel had gone to pieces on the reefs. A look of pity crossed the man's face as he listened, and he cast his eye, as it might be involuntarily, upon the sea, in order to discern some vestige of the stranded ship. "Ah, there is nothing to be seen of our poor schooner," said Dick mournfully. "The last of her was broken up in the storm last night." "And now," interposed Mrs. Weldon, "can you tell us where we are?" "Where?" exclaimed the man, with every indication of surprise at her question. "Why, on the coast of South America, of course." "But on what part? Are we near Peru?" Dick inquired eagerly. "No, my lad, no. You are more to the south. You are on the coast of Bolivia, close to the borders of Chile." "A good distance, I suppose, from Lima?" asked Dick. "From Lima, yes, a long way. Lima is far to the north." "And what is the name of that promontory?" Dick said, pointing to the adjacent headland. "That, I confess, is more than I am able to tell you," replied the stranger, "for although I have travelled a great deal in the interior of the country, I have never before visited this part of the coast." Dick pondered in thoughtful silence over the information he had thus received. He had no reason to doubt its accuracy. According to his own reckoning, he would have expected to come ashore somewhere between the latitudes of 27 degrees and 30 degrees, and by this stranger's showing he had made the latitude 25 degrees. The discrepancy was not very great. It was not more than might be accounted for by the action of the currents, which he knew he had been unable to estimate. Moreover, the deserted character of the whole shore inclined him to believe more easily that he was in Lower Bolivia. Whilst this conversation was going on, Mrs. Weldon, whose suspicion had been excited by Negoro's disappearance, had been scrutinizing the stranger with the utmost attention, but she could not detect anything either in his manner or in his words to give her any cause to doubt his good faith. "Pardon me," she said presently, "but you do not seem to me to be a native of Peru." "No, like yourself, I am an American, Mrs.—" He paused, as if waiting to be told her name. The lady smiled and gave her name. He thanked her and continued, "My name is Harris. I was born in South Carolina, but it is now 20 years since I left my home for the Pampas of Bolivia. Imagine, therefore, how much pleasure it gives me to come across some countrymen of my own." "Do you live in this part of the province, Mr. Harris?" Mrs. Weldon asked. "No, indeed, far away. I live down to the south, close to the borders of Chile. At present I am taking a journey northeastwards to Atacama." "Atacama!" exclaimed Dick. "Are we anywhere near the desert of Atacama?" "Yes, my young friend," rejoined Harris. "You are just on the edge of it. It extends far beyond those mountains which you see on the horizon, and is one of the most curious and least explored parts of the continent." "And are you travelling through it alone?" Mrs. Bowden inquired. "Yes, quite alone. It is not the first time I have performed the journey. One of my brothers owns a large farm, the Hacienda of San Felice, about 200 miles from here, and I have occasion now and then to pay him business visits." After a moment's hesitation, as if he were weighing a sudden thought, he continued, "I am on my way there now, and if you will accompany me, I can promise you a hearty welcome, and my brother will be most happy to do his best to provide you with means of conveyance to San Francisco." Mrs. Weldon had hardly begun to express her thanks for the proposal, when he said abruptly, "Are these negroes your slaves?" "Slaves, sir?" replied Mrs. Weldon, drawing herself up proudly. "We have no slaves in the United States. The South now long followed the example of the North. Slavery is abolished."
"I beg your pardon, madam. I had forgotten that the war of 1862 had solved that question. But seeing these fellows with you, I thought perhaps they might be in your service," he added, with a slight tone of irony.
"We are very proud to be of any service to Mrs. Weldon," Tom interposed with dignity, "but we are no man's property. It is true I was sold for a slave when I was 6 years old, but I have long since had my freedom, and so has my son. Bat here and all his friends were born of free parents."
"Ah, well then, I have to congratulate you," replied Harris, in a manner that jarred very sensibly upon Mrs. Weldon's feelings, but she said nothing. Harris added, "I can assure you that you are as safe here in Bolivia as you would be in New England." He had not finished speaking when Jack, followed by Nan, came out of the grotto. The child was rubbing his eyes, having only just awakened from his night's sleep. Catching sight of his mother, he darted towards her. "What a charming little boy!" exclaimed Harris. "He is my little son," said Mrs. Weldon, kissing the child by way of morning greeting. "Ah, madam, I am sure you must have suffered doubly on his account. Will the little man let me kiss him too?" But there was something in the stranger's appearance that did not take Jack's fancy, and he shrank back timidly to his mother's side. "You must excuse him, sir, he is very shy." "Never mind," said Harris, "we shall be better acquainted by and by. When we get to my brother's, he shall have a nice little pony to ride." But not even this tempting offer seemed to have any effect in coaxing Jack into a more genial mood. He kept fast hold of his mother's hand, and she, somewhat vexed at his behaviour, and anxious that no offence should be given to a man who appeared so friendly in his intentions, hastened to turn the conversation to another topic. Meantime, Dick Sands had been considering Harris's proposal. Upon the whole, the plan of making their way to the hacienda of San Felice seemed to commend itself to his judgment, but he could not conceal from himself that a journey of 200 miles across plains and forests, without any means of transport, would be extremely fatiguing. On expressing his doubts on this point, he was met with the reply, "Oh, that can be managed well enough, young man. Just round the corner of the cliff there I have a horse, which is quite at the disposal of the lady and her son, and by easy stages of 10 miles or so a day, it will do the rest of us no harm to travel on foot. Besides," he added, "when I spoke of the journey being 200 miles, I was thinking of following, as I usually do, the course of the river, but by taking a short cut across the forest, we may reduce the distance by nearly 80 miles. Mrs. Weldon was about to say how grateful she was, but Harris anticipated her. "Not a word, madam, I beg you. You cannot thank me better than by accepting my offer. I confess I have never crossed this forest, but I am so much accustomed to the pampas that I have little fear of losing my way. The only difficulty is in the matter of provisions, as I have only supplied myself with enough to carry me on to San Felice." "As to provisions," replied Mrs. Weldon, "we have enough and to spare, and we shall be more than willing to share everything with you." "This is well," answered Harris. "Then there can be no reason why we should not start at once." He was turning away with the intention of fetching his horse when Dick Sands detained him. True to his seaman's instincts, the young sailor felt that he should be much more at ease on the seashore than traversing the heart of an unknown forest. "Pardon me, Mr. Harris," he began, "but instead of taking so long a journey across the desert of Atacama, would it not be far better for us to follow the coast either northwards or southwards until we reach the nearest seaport?" A frown passed over Harris's countenance. "I know very little about the coast," he answered, "but I know enough to assure you that there is no town to the north within 300 or 400 miles. "Then why should we not go south?" persisted Dick. "You would then have to travel to Chile, which is almost as far, and under your circumstances, I should not advise you to skirt the pampas of the Argentine Republic. For my own part, I could not accompany you." "But do not the vessels which ply between Chile and Peru come within sight of this coast?" interposed Mrs. Weldon. "No, madam, they keep out so far to sea that there would not be the faintest chance of you hailing one." "You seem to have another question to ask, Mr. Harris," Mrs. Weldon continued, addressing Dick, who still looked rather doubtful. Dick replied that he was about to inquire at what port he would be likely to find a ship to convey their party to San Francisco. "That I really cannot tell you, my young friend," rejoined Harris. "I can only repeat my promise that we will furnish you with the means of conveyance from San Felice to Atacama, when no doubt you will obtain all the information you require." "I hope you will not think that Dick is insensible to your kindness, Mr. Harris," said Mrs. Weldon apologetically. "On the contrary," promptly observed Dick, "I am fully appreciated. I only wish we had been cast ashore upon a spot where we should have had no need to intrude upon his generosity." "I assure you, madam, it gives me unbounded pleasure to serve you in any way," said Harris. "It is, as I have told you, not often that I come in contact with any of my own countrymen." "Then we accept your offer as frankly as it is made," replied the lady, adding, "but I cannot consent to deprive you of your horse. I am a very good walker." "So am I," said Harris, with a bow, "and consequently I intend you and your little son to ride. I am used to long tramps through the pampas. Besides, it is not at all unlikely that we shall come across some of the work people belonging to the hacienda. If so, they will be able to give us a mount." Convinced that it would not only be thwarting Mrs. Weldon's wishes to throw any further impediment in the way, Dick Sands suppressed his desire to raise fresh obstacles, and simply asked how soon they ought to start.
"This very day, at once," said Harris quickly.
"So soon?" asked Dick.
"Yes, the rainy season begins in April, and the sooner we are at San Felice the better. The way through the forest is the safest as well as the shortest, for we shall be less likely to meet any of the nomad Indians, who are notorious robbers." Without making any direct reply, Dick proceeded to instruct the negroes to choose such of the positions as more easy of transport, and to take them up into packages, that every one might carry a due share. Hercules, with his usual good nature, professed himself willing to carry the entire load, a proposal, however, to which Dick would not listen for a moment. "You are a fine fellow, Hercules," said Harris, scrutinizing the giant with the eye of a connoisseur. "You will be worth something in the African market." "Those who want me now must catch me first," retorted Hercules with a grin. The services of all hands were enlisted, and in a comparatively short time sufficient food was packed up to supply the party for about 10 days' march. "You must allow us to show you what hospitality is in our power," said Mrs. Weldon, addressing her new acquaintance. "Our breakfast will be ready in a quarter of an hour, and we shall be happy if you will join us."
"It will give me much pleasure," answered Harris gaily. "I will employ the interval in fetching my horse, who has breakfasted already."
"I will accompany you," said Dick.
"By all means, my young friend, come with me, and I will show you the lower part of the river." While they were gone, Hercules was sent in search of Cousin Benedict, who was wandering on the top of the cliff in quest of some wonderful insect, which, of course, was not to be found. Without asking his permission, Hercules unceremoniously brought him back to Mrs. Weldon, who explained how they were about to start upon a 10 days' march into the interior of the country. The entomologist was quite satisfied with the arrangement, and declared himself ready for a march across the entire continent, as long as he was free to be adding to his collection on the way. Thus assured of her cousin's acquiescence in her plans, Mrs. Weldon proceeded to prepare such a substantial meal as she hoped would invigorate them all for the approaching journey. Harris and Dick Sands, meantime, had turned the corner of the cliff and walked about 300 paces along the shore until they came to a tree to which a horse was tethered. The creature neighed as it recognized its master. It was a strong-built animal, of a kind that Dick had not seen before, although its long neck and crupper, short loins, flat shoulders, and arched forehead indicated that it was of Arabian breed. "Plenty of strength here," Harris said, as after unfastening the horse, he took it by the bridle and began to lead it along the shore. Dick made no reply. He was casting a hasty glance at the forest, which enclosed them on either hand. It was an unattractive sight, but he observed nothing to give him any particular ground for uneasiness. Turning round, he said abruptly, "Did you meet a Portuguese last night, named Negoro?"
"Negoro? Who is Negoro?" asked Harris, in a tone of surprise.
"He was our ship's cook, but he has disappeared."
"Drowned, probably," said Harris indifferently.
"No, he was not drowned. He was with us during the evening, but left afterwards. I thought perhaps you might have met him along the riverside, as you came that way."
"No," said Harris, "I saw no one. If your cook ventured along into the forest, most likely he has lost his way. It is possible we may pick him up upon our road."
When they arrived at the grotto, they found breakfast duly prepared. Like the supper of the previous evening, it consisted mainly of corned beef and biscuit. Harris did ample justice to the repast. "There is no fear of our starving as we go," he observed, Mrs. Weldon, "but I can hardly say so much for the unfortunate Portuguese, your cook, of whom my young friend here has been speaking."
"Ah, has Dick been telling you about Negoro?" Mrs. Weldon said.
Dick explained that he had been inquiring whether Mr. Harris had happened to meet him in the direction he had come.
"I saw nothing of him," Harris repeated, "and as he has deserted you, you need not give yourselves any concern about him." And apparently glad to turn the subject, he said, "Now, madam, I am at your service. Shall we start at once?"
It was agreed that there was no cause for delay. Each one took up the package that had been assigned him. Mrs. Weldon, with Hercules' help, mounted the horse, and Jack, with his miniature gun slung across his shoulder, was placed astride in front of her. Without a thought of acknowledging the kindness of the good-natured stranger in providing him so enjoyable a ride, the heedless little fellow declared himself quite capable of guiding the gentleman's horse, and when to indulge him the bridle was put into his hand, he looked as proud as though he had been appointed leader of the whole caravan. End of part the first, chapter 15. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. www.alexhetelander.com. Part the first, chapter 16 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. translated by Ellen E. Fuhr. Part the First, Chapter 16. Through the Forest. Although there was no obvious cause for apprehension, it cannot be denied that it was with a certain degree of foreboding that Dick Sands first entered that dense forest, through which for the next 10 days they were to wend their toilsome way. Mrs. Weldon, on the contrary, was full of confidence and hope. A woman and a mother, she might have been expected to be conscious of anxiety at the peril to which she might be exposing herself and her child, and doubtless she would have been sensible of alarm if her mind had not been fully satisfied upon two points. First, that the portion of the pampas that they were about to traverse was little infested either by natives or by dangerous beasts, and secondly, that she was under the protection of a guide so trustworthy as she believed Harris to be. The entrance to the forest was hardly more than 300 paces up the river. An order of march had been arranged, which was to be observed as closely as possible throughout the journey. At the head of the troop were Harris and Dick Sands, one armed with his long gun, the other with his Remington. Next came Bat and Austin, each carrying a gun and a cutlass, then Mrs. Weldon and Jack on horseback, closely followed by Tom and old Nan, while Actaeon with the fourth Remington and Hercules with a huge hatchet in his waist belt brought up the rear. Dingo had no especial place in the procession, but wandered to and fro at his pleasure. Ever since he had been cast ashore, Dick had noticed a remarkable change in the dog's behavior. The animal was in a constant state of agitation, always apparently on the search for some lost scent, and repeatedly giving vent to a low growl, which seemed to proceed from grief rather than from rage. As for Cousin Benedict, his movements were permitted to be nearly as erratic as Dingo's. Nothing but a leading string could possibly have kept him in the ranks. With his tin box under his arm, and his butterfly net in his hand, and his huge magnifying glass suspended from his neck, he would be sometimes far ahead, sometimes a long way behind, and at the risk of being attacked by some venomous snake, would make frantic dashes into the tall grass whenever he espied some attractive orthoptera or other insect which he thought might be honored by a place in his collection. In 1 hour after starting, Mrs. Weldon had called to him a dozen times without the slightest effect. At last she told him seriously that if she would not give up chasing the insects at a distance, she should be obliged to take possession of his tin box. "Take away my box!" he cried, with as much horror as if she had threatened to tear out his vitals. "Yes, your box and your net, too." "My box and my net? But surely not my spectacles!" almost shrieked the excited entomologist. "Yes, and your spectacles as well," added Mrs. Weldon mercilessly. "I am glad you have reminded me of another means of reducing you to obedience." The triple penalty of which he was thus warned had the effect of keeping him from wandering away for the best part of the next hour. But he was soon once more missing from the ranks. He was manifestly incorrigible. The deprivation of box, net, and spectacles would, it was acknowledged, be utterly without avail to prevent him from rambling. Accordingly, it was thought better to let him have his own way, especially as Hercules volunteered to keep his eye upon him and to endeavour to guard the worthy naturalist as carefully as he would himself protect some precious specimen of Lepidoptera. Further anxiety on his account was thus put to rest. In spite of Harris's confident assertions that they were little likely to be molested by any of the nomad Indians, the whole company rejoiced in feeling that they were well armed, and they resolved to keep in a compact body. The way across the forest could scarcely be called a path. It was, in fact, little more than the track of animals, and progress along it was necessarily very slow. Indeed, it seemed impossible, at the rate they started, to accomplish more than 5 or 6 miles in the course of 12 hours. The weather was beautifully fine, the sun ascended nearly to the zenith, and its rays descending almost perpendicularly caused a degree of heat which, as Harris pointed out, would have been unendurable upon the open plain, but was here pleasantly tempered by the shelter of the foliage. Most of the trees were quite strange to them. To an experienced eye they were such as were remarkable more for their character than for their size. Here on one side was the bauhinia, or mountain ebony, there on the other the molompi, or pterocarpus, its trunk exuding large quantities of resin, and of which the strong light wood makes excellent oars or paddles. Further on were few sticks heavily charged with colouring matter, and guaiacums, 12 feet in diameter, surpassing the ordinary kind in magnitude, yet far inferior in quality. Dick Sands kept perpetually asking Harris to tell him the names of all these trees and plants. "Have you never been on the coast of South America before?" replied Harris, without giving the explicit information that was sought. "Never," said Dick, "never before. Nor do I recollect ever having seen any one who has." "But surely you have explored the coasts of Colombia or Patagonia," Harris continued. Dick avowed that he had never had the chance. "But has Mrs. Weldon never visited these parts? Our countrymen, I know, are great travellers." "No," answered Mrs. Weldon. "My husband's business called him occasionally to New Zealand, but I have accompanied him nowhere else. With this part of Lower Bolivia we are totally unacquainted." "Then, madam, I can only assure you that you will see a most remarkable country. in every way a very striking contrast to the regions of Peru, Brazil, and the Argentine Republic. Its animal and vegetable products would fill a naturalist with unbounded wonder. May I not declare it a lucky chance that has brought you here? Do not say chance, Mr. Harris, if you please.
Well then, madam, providence, if you prefer it, said Harris, with the air of a man incapable of recognizing the distinction.
After finding that there was no one amongst them who was acquainted in any way with the country through which they were travelling, Harris seemed to exhibit an evident pleasure in pointing out and describing by name the various wonders of the forest. Had Cousin Benedict's attainments included a knowledge of botany, he would have found himself in a fine field of researches, and might perchance have discovered novelties to which his own name could be appended in the catalogues of science. But he was no botanist. In fact, as a rule, he held all blossoms in aversion, on the ground that they entrapped insects into their corollae, and poisoned them sometimes with venomous juices. New and rare insects, however, seemed hereabouts to be wanting. Occasionally the soil became marshy, and they had all to wend their way over a perfect network of tiny rivulets that were affluents of the river from which they had started. Sometimes these rivulets were so wide that they could not be passed without a long search for some spot where they could be forded. Their banks were all very damp, and in many places abounded with a kind of reed which Harris called by its proper name of papyrus. As soon as the marshy district had been passed, the forest resumed its original aspect, the footway becoming narrow as ever. Harris pointed out some very fine ebony trees, larger than the common sort, and yielding a wood darker and more durable than what is ordinarily seen in the market. There were also more mango trees than might have been expected at this distance from the sea. A beautiful white lichen enveloped their trunks like a fur, but in spite of their luxuriant foliage and delicious fruit, Harris said that there was not a native who would venture to propagate the species, as the superstition of the country is that whoever plants a mango dies. At noon a halt was made for the purpose of rest and refreshment. During the afternoon they arrived at some gently rising ground, not the first slope of hills, but an insulated plateau which appeared to unite mountains and plains. Notwithstanding that the trees were far less crowded and more inclined to grow in detached groups, the numbers of herbaceous plants with which the soil was covered rendered progress no less difficult than it was before. The general aspect of the scene was not unlike an East Indian jungle. Less luxuriant, indeed, than in the lower valley of the river, the vegetation was far more abundant than that of the temperate zones either of the old or new continents. Indigo grew in great profusion, and, according to Harris's representation, was the most encroaching plant in the whole country. No sooner, he said, was a field left untilled than it was overrun by this parasite, which sprang up the rank growth of thistles or nettles. One tree, which might have been expected to be common in this part of the continent, seemed entirely wanting. This was the caoutchouc. Of the various trees from which India rubber is procured, such as the ficus prionoides, the castilioi elastica, the cecropia peltata, the calophora utilis, the cameraria latifolia, and especially the siphonia elastica, all of which abound in the provinces of South America, not a single specimen was to be seen. Dick had promised to show Jack an India rubber tree, and the child, who had conjured up visions of squeaking dolls, balls, and other toys growing up upon its branches, was loud and constant in his expressions of disappointment. "Never mind, my little man," said Harris. "Have patience, and you shall see hundreds of India rubber trees when you get to the hacienda."
"And will they be nice and elastic?" asked Jack, whose ideas upon the subject were of the vaguest order.
"Oh yes, they will stretch as long as you like," Harris answered, laughing. "But here is something to amuse you," he added, as he spoke. He gathered a fruit that looked as tempting as a peach. "You are quite sure that it is safe to give to him?" asked Mrs. Weldon, anxiously.
"To satisfy you, madam, I will eat one first myself." The example he set was soon followed by all the rest. The fruit was a mango. That which had been so opportunely discovered was of the sort that ripens in March or April. There is a later kind which ripens in September. With his mouth full of juice, Jack pronounced that it was very nice, but did not seem to be altogether diverted from his sense of disappointment at not coming to an India rubber tree. Evidently the little man thought himself rather injured.
"And Dick promised me some hummingbirds, too," he murmured.
"Plenty of hummingbirds for you when you get to the farm, lots of them where my brother lives," said Harris.
And to say the truth, there was nothing extravagant in the way the child's anticipations had been raised, for in Bolivia hummingbirds are found in great abundance. The Indians, who weave their plumage into all kinds of artistic designs, have bestowed the most poetical epithets upon these gems of the feathered race. They call them rays of the sun, and tresses of the day star. At one time they would describe them as king of flowers, at another as blossoms of heaven kissing blossoms of earth, or as the jewel that reflects the sunbeam. In fact, their imagination seems to have shaped a suitable distinction for almost every one of the 150 known species of this dazzling little beauty. But however numerous hummingbirds might be expected to be in the Bolivian forest, they proved scarce enough at present, and Jack had to content himself with Harris's representations that they did not like solitude, but would be found plentifully at San Felice, where they would be heard all day long humming like a spinning wheel. Already Jack said he longed to be there, a wish that was so unanimously echoed by all the rest that they resolved that no stoppage should be allowed beyond what was absolutely indispensable. After a time, the forest began to alter its aspect. The trees were even less crowded, opening now and then into wide glades. The soil, cropping up above its carpet of verdure, exhibited veins of rose granite and syenite, like plates of lapis lazuli. On some of the higher ground, the fleshy tubers of the sarsaparilla plant, growing in a hopeless entanglement, made progress a matter of still greater difficulty than in the narrow tracks of the dense forest. At sunset, the travellers found that they had accomplished about 8 miles from their starting point. They could not prognosticate what hardships might be in store for them on future days, but it was certain that the experience of the first day had been neither eventful nor very fatiguing. It was now unanimously agreed that they should make a halt for the night, and as little was to be apprehended from the attacks either of man or beast, it was considered unnecessary to form anything like the regular encampment. One man on guard, to be relieved every few hours, was presumed to be sufficient. Admirable shelter was offered by an enormous mango, the spreading foliage of which formed a kind of natural veranda, sweeping the ground so thoroughly that anyone who chose could find sleeping quarters in its very branches. Simultaneously with the halting of the party, there was heard a deafening tumult in the upper boughs. The mango was the roosting place of a colony of grey parrots, a noisy, quarrelsome, and rapacious race, of whose true characteristics the specimens seen in confinement in Europe give no true conception. Their screeching and chattering was such a nuisance that Dick Sands wanted to fire a shot into the middle of them, but Harris seriously dissuaded him, urging that the report of firearms would only serve to reveal their own presence, whilst their greatest safety lay in perfect silence. Supper was prepared. There was little need of cooking. The meal, as before, consisted of preserved meat and biscuit. Fresh water, which they flavoured with a few drops of rum, was obtained from the adjacent stream which trickled through the grass. By way of dessert, they had an abundance of ripe mangoes, and the only drawback to their general enjoyment was the discordant outcry which the parrots kept up, as it were in protest against the invasion of what they held to be their own rightful domain. It was nearly dark when supper was ended. The evening shade crept slowly upwards to the tops of the trees, which soon stood out in sharp relief against the lighter background of the sky, while the stars, one by one, began to peep. The wind dropped, and ceased to murmur through the foliage. To the general relief, the parrots desisted from their clatter, and as nature hushed herself to rest, she seemed to be inviting all her children to follow her example. "Have we not better light a good large fire?" asked Dick. "By no means," said Harris. "The nights are not cold, and under this wide-spreading mango the ground is not likely to be damp. Besides, as I have told you before, our best security consists in our taking care to attract no attention whatever from without." Mrs. Weldon interposed. "It may be true enough that we have nothing to dread from the Indians, but is it certain that there are no dangerous quadrupeds against which we are bound to be upon our guard?" Harris answered, "I can positively assure you, madam, that there are no animals here but such as would be infinitely more afraid of you than you would be of them." "Are there any woods without wild beasts?" asked Jack. "All woods are not alike, my boy," replied Harris. "This wood is a great park. As the Indians say, es como el paraíso. It is like paradise." Jack persisted. "There must be snakes and lions and tigers." "Ask your mamma, my boy," said Harris, "whether she ever heard of lions and tigers in America." Mrs. Weldon was endeavouring to put her little boy at ease on this point when Cousin Benedict interposed, saying that although there were no lions or tigers, there were plenty of jaguars and panthers in the New World. "And won't they kill us?" demanded Jack eagerly, his apprehensions once more aroused. "Kill you?" laughed Harris. "Why, your friend Hercules here could strangle them, two at a time, one in each hand." "But please, don't let the panthers come near me," pleaded Jack, evidently alarmed. "No, no, Master Jack, they shall not come near you. I will give them a good grip first," said the giant, displaying his two rows of huge white teeth. Dick Sands proposed that it should be the four younger negroes who should be assigned the task of keeping watch during the night, in attendance upon himself. But Actaeon insisted so strongly upon the necessity of Dick's having his full share of rest that the others were soon brought to the same conviction, and Dick was obliged to yield. Jack valiantly announced his intention of taking one watch, but his sleepy eyelids made it only too plain that he did not know the extent of his own fatigue. "I am sure there are wolves here," he said. "Only such wolves as Dingo would swallow at a mouthful," said Harris. "But I am sure there are wolves," he insisted, repeating the word "wolves" again and again, until he tumbled off to sleep against the side of old Nan. Mrs. Weldon gave her little son a silent kiss. It was her loving good night. Cousin Benedict was missing. Some little time before, he had slipped away in search of cocuyos, or fireflies, which he had heard were common in South America. Those singular insects emit a bright bluish light from two spots on the side of the thorax, and their colors are so brilliant that they are used as ornaments for ladies' headdresses. Hoping to secure some specimens for his box, Benedict would have wandered to an unlimited distance, but Hercules, faithful to his undertaking, soon discovered him, and heedless of the naturalist's protestations and vociferations, promptly escorted him back to the general rendezvous. Hercules himself was the first to keep watch, but with this exception, the whole party, in another hour, were wrapped in peaceful slumber. End of part the first. Chapter 16. Recorded by Alex Italander, Davis, California. www.alexitalander.com. Part the First, Chapter 17 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alex C. Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne. Translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 17. Misgivings. Most travelers who have passed a night in a South American forest have been roused from their slumbers by a matinee musicale, more fantastic than melodious, performed by monkeys as their ordinary greeting of the dawn. The yelling, chattering, screeching, howling all unite to form a chorus almost unearthly in its hideousness. Amongst the various specimens of the numerous family of the quadrumana ought to be recognized the little mariquina, the saguin, with its parti-colored face, the gray mora, the skin of which is used by the Indians for covering their gunlocks, the sapaju, with his singular tuft over the forehead, and most miracle of all, the guariva, Simia bilsbo, with its prehensile tail and diabolical countenance. At the first streak of daylight, the senior members, as choragus, will start the keynote in a sonorous baritone. The younger monkeys join in tenor and alto, and the concert begins. But this morning there was no concert at all. There was nothing of the wonted serenade to break the silence of the forest. The shrill notes resulting from the rapid vibration of the hyoid bones of the throat were not to be heard. Indians would have been disappointed and perplexed. They are very fond of the flesh of the guariba when smoked and dried, and they would certainly have missed the chant of the monkey paternosters. But Dick Sands and his companions were unfamiliar with any of these things, and accordingly this singular quietude was to them a matter of no surprise. They all awoke much refreshed by their night's rest, which there had been nothing to disturb. Jack was by no means the latest in opening his eyes, and his first words were addressed to Hercules, asking him whether he had caught a wolf with his teeth. Hercules had to acknowledge that he had tasted nothing all night, and declared himself quite ready for breakfast. The whole party were unanimous in this respect, and after a brief morning prayer, breakfast was expeditiously served by old Nan. The meal was by a repetition of the last evening's supper, but with their appetites sharpened by the fresh forest air, and anxious to fortify themselves for a good day's march, they did not fail to do ample justice to their simple fare. Even Cousin Benedict, for once in his life at least, partook of his food as if it were not utterly a matter of indifference to him. But he grumbled very much at the restraint to which he considered himself subjected. He could not see the good of coming to such a country as this, if he were to be obliged to walk about with his hands in his pockets, and he protested that if Hercules did not leave him alone and permit him to catch fireflies, there would be a bone to pick between them. Hercules did not look very much alarmed at the threat. Mrs. Weldon, however, took him aside, and telling him that she did not wish to deprive the enthusiast entirely of his favorite occupation, instructed him to allow her cousin as much liberty as possible, provided he did not lose sight of him. The morning meal was over, and it was only 7 o'clock when the travellers were once more on their way towards the east, preserving the same marching order as the day before. The path was still through luxuriant forests, the vegetable kingdom reigned supreme. As the plateau was immediately adjacent to tropical latitudes, the sun's rays during the summer months descended perpendicularly upon the virgin soil, and the vast amount of heat thus obtained, combined with the abundant moisture retained in the subsoil, caused vegetation to assume a character which was truly magnificent. Dick Sands could not overcome a certain sense of mystification. Here they were, as Harris told them, in the region of the Pampas, a word which he knew in the Kichna dialect signifies a plain, but he had always read that these plains were characterized by a deficiency alike of water, of trees, and rocks. He had always understood that during the rainy season thistles spring up in great abundance and grow until they form thickets that are well-nigh impenetrable. He had imagined that the few dwarf trees and prickly shrubs that exist during the summer only stamp the general scene with an aspect of yet more thorough barrenness and desolation. But how different was everything to all this? The forest never ceased to stretch away interminably to the horizon. There were no tokens of the rough nakedness that he had expected. Dick seemed to be driven to the conclusion that Harris was right in describing this plateau of Atacama, which he had for this part most firmly believed to be a vast desert between the Andes and the Pacific, as a region that was quite exceptional in its natural features. It was not in Dick's character to keep his reflections to himself. In the course of the morning, he expressed his extreme surprise at finding the Pampas answer so little to his preconceived ideas. "Have I not understood correctly," he said, "that the Pampas is similar to the North American savannas, only less marshy?" Harris replied that such was indeed a correct description of the Pampas of Rio Colorado, and the Llanos of Venezuela and Orinoco. "But," he continued, "I own I am as much astonished as yourself at the character of this region. I have never crossed the plateau before, and I must confess it is altogether different to what you might find beyond the Andes toward the Atlantic." "You don't mean that we are going to cross the Andes?" said Dick, in sudden alarm. Harris smiled. "No, no, indeed. With our limited means of transport, such an undertaking would have been rash in the extreme. We had better have kept to the coast forever rather than incur such a risk. Our destination, San Felice, is on this side of the range, and in order to reach it, we shall not have to leave the plateau, of which the greatest elevation is but little over 1,500 feet. "And you say," Dick persisted, "that you have really no fear of losing your way in a forest such as this, a forest into which you have never set foot before?" "No fear whatever," Harris answered. "So accustomed am I to travelling of this kind that I can steer my way by a thousand signs revealing themselves in the growth of the trees, and in the composition of the soil, which would never present themselves to your notice. I assure you that I anticipate no difficulties." This conversation was not heard by any of the rest of the party. Harris seemed to speak as frankly as he did fearlessly, and Dick felt that there might be, after all, no just grounds for any of his own misgivings. 5 days passed by, and the 12th of April arrived without any special incident. 9 miles had been the average distance accomplished in a day, regular periods of rest had been taken, and, except that Jack's spirits had somewhat flagged, the fatigue did not seem to interfere with the general good health of the travellers. First disappointed of his India rubber tree, and then of his hummingbirds, Jack had inquired about the beautiful parrots which he had been led to expect he should see in the wonderful forest. Where were the bright green macaws? Where were the gaudy aras with their bare white cheeks and pointed tails, which seemed never to light upon the ground? And where, too, were all the brilliant paroquets, with their feathered faces, and indeed the whole variety of those forest characters, of which the Indians affirm that they speak the language of nations long extinct? It is true that there was no lack of the common grey parrots with crimson tails, but they were no novelty. Jack had seen plenty of them before, for owing to their reputation of being the most clever in mimicry of the cetacidae, they had been domesticated everywhere in both the Old and New Worlds. But Jack's dissatisfaction was nothing compared to Cousin Benedict's. In spite of being allowed to wander around from the rank, he had failed to discover a single insect which was worth the pursuit. Not even a firefly danced at night. Nature seemed to be mocking him, and his ill-humor increased accordingly. In this way the journey was continued for 4 days longer, and on the 16th it was estimated that they must have traveled between 80 and 90 miles northeastwards from the coast. Harris positively asserted that they could not be much more than 20 miles from San Felice, and that by pushing forwards they might expect in 8 and 40 hours to find themselves lodged in comfortable quarters. But although they had thus succeeded in traversing this vast tableland, they had not seen one human inhabitant. Dick was more than ever perplexed, and it was a subject of bitter regret to him that they had not stranded upon some more frequented part of the shore, near some village or plantation where Mrs. Weldon might long since have found a suitable refuge. Deserted, however, as the country apparently was by man, it had latterly shown itself much more abundantly tenanted by animals. Many a time a long, plaintive cry was heard, which Harris attributed to the tardigrades, or sloths, often found in wooden districts, and known by the name of ice, and in the middle of the dinner halt on this day, a loud hissing suddenly broke upon the air, which made Mrs. Weldon start to her feet in alarm. "A serpent!" cried Dick, catching up his loaded gun. The negroes, following Dick's example, were in a moment on the alert. "Don't fire!" cried Harris. There was indeed nothing improbable in the supposition that a sucuru, a species of boa, sometimes measuring 40 feet in length, had just moved itself in the long grass at their side. But Harris affirmed that the sucuru never hisses, and declared that the noise had really come from animals of an entirely inoffensive character. "What animals?" asked Dick, always eager for information, which it must be granted Harris seemed always equally anxious to give. "Antelopes," replied Harris. "But hush, not a sound, or you will frighten them away." "Antelopes?" cried Dick. "I must see them. I must get close to them." "More easily said than done," answered Harris, shaking his head. But Dick was not to be diverted from his purpose, and gun in hand crept into the grass. He had not advanced many yards before a herd of about a dozen gazelles, graceful in body, with short pointed horns, dashed past him like a glowing cloud, and disappeared in the underwood without giving him time to take a shot. "I told you beforehand what you would have to expect," said Harris, as Dick, with a considerable sense of disappointment, returned to the party. Impossible, however, as it had been fairly to scrutinize the antelopes, such was hardly the case with another herd of animals, the identification of which led to a somewhat singular discussion between Harris and the rest. About 4 o'clock on the afternoon of the same day, the travellers were halting for a few moments near an opening in the forest, when 3 or 4 large animals emerged from a thicket about 100 paces ahead, and scampered off at full speed. In spite of what Harris had urged, Dick put his gun to his shoulder, and was on the very point of firing when Harris knocked the rifle quickly aside. "There were giraffes!" shouted Dick. The announcement awakened the curiosity of Jack, who quickly scrambled to his feet upon the saddle on which he was lounging. "My dear Dick," said Mrs. Weldon, "there are no giraffes in America." "Certainly not," cried Harris. "They were not giraffes. They were ostriches which you saw." "Ostriches with 4 legs? That will never do. What do you say, Mrs. Weldon?" Mrs. Weldon replied that she had certainly taken the animals for quadrupeds, and all the negroes were under the same impression. Laughing heartily, Harris said it was far from an uncommon thing for an inexperienced eye to mistake a large ostrich for a small giraffe. The shape of both was so similar that it often quite escaped observation as to whether the long necks terminated in a beak or a muzzle. Besides, what need of discussion could there be when the fact was established that giraffes are unknown in the New World? The reasoning was plausible enough, and Mrs. Weldon and the negroes were soon convinced, but Dick was far from satisfied. "I did not know that there was an American ostrich," he again objected. "Oh yes," replied Harris, "there is a species called the Nandu, which is very well known here. We shall probably see some more of them." The statement was correct. The Nandu is common in the plains of South America, and is distinguished from the African ostrich by having 3 toes, all furnished with claws. It is a fine bird, sometimes exceeding 6 feet in height. It has a short beak, and its wings are furnished with blue-gray plumes. Harris appeared well acquainted with the bird, and proceeded to give a very precise account of its habits. In concluding his remarks, he again pressed upon Dick his most urgent request that he should abstain from firing upon any animal whatever. It was of the utmost consequence. Dick made no reply. He was silent and thoughtful. Grave doubts had arisen in his mind, and he could neither explain nor dispel them. When the march was resumed on the following day, Harris asserted his conviction that another 4 and 20 hours would bring them to the hacienda. "And there, madam," he said, addressing Mrs. Weldon, "we can offer you every essential comfort, though you may not find the luxuries of your own home in San Francisco." Mrs. Weldon repeated her expression of gratitude for the proffered hospitality, owning that she should now be exceedingly glad to reach the farm, as she was anxious about her little son, who appeared to be threatened with the symptoms of incipient fever. Harris could not deny that although the climate was usually very healthy, it nevertheless did occasionally produce a kind of intermittent fever during March and April. "But nature has provided the proper remedy," said Dick, and perceiving that Harris did not comprehend his meaning, he continued, "Are we not in the region of the quinquinas, the bark of which is notoriously the medicine with which attacks of fever are usually treated? For my part, I am amazed that we have not seen numbers of them already." "Ah, yes, yes, I know what you mean," answered Harris, after a moment's hesitation. "They are trees, however, not always easy to find. They rarely grow in groups, and in spite of their large leaves and fragrant red blossom, the Indians themselves often have a difficulty in recognizing them. The feature that distinguishes them most is the evergreen foliage." At Mrs. Weldon's request, Harris promised to point out the tree if he should see one, but added that when she reached the hacienda, she would be able to obtain some sulfate of quinine, which was much more efficacious than the unprepared bark. [Footnote: This bark was formerly reduced to powder, known as pulvis jesuiticus, because in the year 1649 the Jesuits in Rome imported a large quantity of it from their missionaries in South America. The day passed without further incident. No rain had fallen at present, though the warm mist that rose from the soil betokened an approaching change of weather. The rainy season was certainly not far distant, but to travellers who indulged the expectation of being in a few hours in a place of shelter, this was not a matter of great concern. Evening came, and a halt was made for the night beneath a grove of lofty trees. If Harris had not miscalculated, they could hardly be more than 6 miles from their destination. So confirmed, however, was Dick Sands in his strange suspicions that nothing could induce him to relax any of his usual precautions, and he particularly insisted upon the negroes, turn by turn, keeping up the accustomed watch. Worn out by fatigue, the little party was glad to lie down, but they had scarcely dropped off to sleep when they were aroused by a sharp cry. "Who's that? Who's there? What's the matter?" exclaimed Dick, the first to rise to his feet. "It is I," answered Benedict's voice. "I am bitten. Something has bitten me." "A snake!" exclaimed Mrs. Weldon in alarm. "No, no, cousin. Better than that. It was not a snake. I believe it was an orthoptera. I have it all right," he shouted triumphantly. "Then kill it quickly, sir, and let us go to sleep again in peace," said Harris. "Kill it, not for the world. I must have a light, and look at it." Dick Sands indulged him, for reasons of his own, in getting a light. The entomologist carefully opened his hand and displayed an insect somewhat smaller than a bee, of a dull colour, streaked with yellow on the under portion of the body. He looked radiant with delight. "A diptera!" he exclaimed, half beside himself with joy. "A most famous diptera!" "Is it venomous?" asked Mrs. Weldon. "Not at all to men. It only hurts elephants and buffaloes." "But tell us its name. What is it?" cried Dick impetuously. The naturalist began to speak in a slow, oracular tone. "The insect is here a prodigy. It is an insect totally unknown in this country. In America..." "Tell us its name!" roared Dick. "It is a tsetse, sir, a true tsetse." Dick's heart sank like a stone. He was speechless. He did not, dared not, ask more. Only too well he knew where the tsetse could alone be found. He did not close his eyes again that night. End of part the first. Chapter 17. Recording by Alexey Talander, Davis, California. www.alexeytalander.com. Part the first. Chapter 18 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alexey Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the First, Chapter 18, A Terrible Discovery. The morning of the 18th dawned, the day on which, according to Harris's prediction, the travellers were to be safely housed at San Felice. Mrs. Weldon was really much relieved at the prospect, for she was aware that her strength must prove inadequate to the strain of a more protracted journey. The condition of her little boy, who was alternately flushed with fever and pale with exhaustion, had begun to cause her great anxiety, and unwilling to resign the care of the child even to Nan, his faithful nurse, she insisted upon carrying him in her own arms. 12 days and nights passed in the open air had done much to try her powers of endurance, and the charge of a sick child in addition would soon break down her strength entirely. Dick Sands, Nan, and the negroes had all borne the march very fairly. Their stock of provisions, though of course considerably diminished, was still far from small. As for Harris, he had shown himself preeminently adapted for forest life, and capable of bearing any amount of fatigue. Yet, strange to say, as he approached the end of the journey, his manner underwent a remarkable change. Instead of conversing in his ordinary frank and easy way, he became silent and preoccupied, as if engrossed in his own thoughts. Perhaps he had had an instinctive consciousness that his young friend, as he was, in the habit of addressing Dick, was entertaining hard suspicions about him. The march was resumed. The trees once again ceased to be crowded in impenetrable masses, but soon in clusters at considerable distances apart. Now Dick tried to argue with himself. They must be coming to the true pampas, or the man must be designedly misleading them. And yet what motive could he have? Although during the earlier part of the day there occurred nothing that could be said absolutely to justify Dick's increasing uneasiness, two circumstances transpired which did not escape his observation, and which he felt might be significant. The first of these was a sudden change in Dingo's behaviour. The dog, throughout the march, had uniformly run along with his nose upon the ground, smelling the grass and shrubs, and occasionally uttering a sad low whine, but today he seemed all agitation. He scampered about with bristling coat, with his head erect, and ever and again burst into one of those furious fits of barking, with which he had formerly been accustomed to greet Negoro's appearance upon the deck of the Pilgrim. The idea that flitted across Dick's mind was shared by Tom. "Look, Mr. Dick, look at Dingo. He is at his old ways again," he said. "It is just as if Negoro..." "Hush," said Dick to the old man, who continued in a lower voice. "It is just as if Negoro had followed us. Do you think it is likely?" "It might perhaps be to his advantage to follow us, if he doesn't know the country. But if he does know the country, why then..." Dick did not finish his sentence, but whistled to Dingo. The dog reluctantly obeyed his call. As soon as the dog was at his side, Dick patted him, repeating, "Good dog, good Dingo, where's Negoro?" The sound of Negoro's name had its usual effect. It seemed to irritate the animal exceedingly, and he barked furiously, and apparently wanted to dash into the thicket. Harris had been an interested spectator of the scene, and now approached with a peculiar expression on his countenance, and inquired what they were saying to Dingo. "Oh, nothing much," replied Tom. "We were only asking him for news of a lost acquaintance." "Ah, I suppose you mean that Portuguese cook of yours." "Yes," answered Tom. "We fancied from Dingo's behaviour that Negoro must be somewhere close at hand." "Why don't you send and search the Underwood? Perhaps the poor wretch is in distress." "No need of that, Mr. Harris. Negoro, I have no doubt, is quite capable of taking care of himself." "Well, just as you please, my young friend," said Harris, with an air of indifference. Dick turned away. He continued his endeavours to pacify Dingo, and the conversation dropped. The other thing that had arrested Dick's attention was the behaviour of the horse. If they had been as near the hacienda as Harris described, would not the animal have pricked up its ears, sniffed the air, and with dilated nostril exhibited some sign of satisfaction, as being upon familiar ground? But nothing of the kind was to be observed. The horse plodded along as unconcernedly as if a stable were as far away as ever. Even Mrs. Weldon was not so engrossed with her child, but what she was fain to express her wonder was at the deserted aspect of the country. No trace of a farm labourer was anywhere to be seen. She cast her eyes at Harris, who was in his usual place in front, and observing how he was looking first to the left and then to the right, with the air of a man who was uncertain of his path, she asked herself whether it was possible their guide might have lost his way. She dared not entertain the idea, and averted her eyes, that she might not be harassed by his movements. After crossing an open plain about a mile in width, the travellers once again entered the forest, which resumed something of the same denseness that had characterized it further to the west. In the course of the afternoon they came to a spot which was marked very distinctly by the vestiges of some enormous animals, which must have passed quite recently. As Dick looked carefully about him, he observed that the branches were all torn off or broken to a considerable height, and that the foot tracks in the trampled grass were much too large to be those either of jaguars or panthers. Even if it were possible that the prints on the ground had been made by eyes or other tardigrades, this would fail to account in the least for the trees being broken to such a height. Elephants alone were capable of working such destruction in the underwood, but elephants were unknown in America. Dick was puzzled, but controlled himself so that he would not apply to Harris for any enlightenment. His intuition made him aware that a man who had once tried to make him believe that giraffes were ostriches would not hesitate a second time to impose upon his credulity. More than ever was Dick becoming convinced that Harris was a traitor, and he was secretly prompted to tax him with his treachery. Still, he was obliged to own that he could not assign any motive for the man acting in such a manner with the survivors of the Pilgrim, and consequently hesitated before he actually condemned him for conduct so base and heartless. What could be done? He repeatedly asked himself. On board ship, the boy captain might perchance have been able to have devised some plan for the safety of those so strangely committed to his charge, but here on an unknown shore he could only suffer from the burden of this responsibility the more, because he was so utterly powerless to act. He made up his mind on one point. He determined not to alarm the poor anxious mother a moment before he was actually compelled. It was his carrying out this determination that explained why, on subsequently arriving at a considerable stream, where he saw some huge heads, swollen muzzles, long tusks, and unwieldy bodies rising from the midst of rank, wet grass, he uttered no word and gave no gesture of surprise. But only too well he knew, at a glance, that he must be looking at a herd of hippopotamuses. It was a weary march that day. A general feeling of depression spread involuntarily from one to the other. Hardly conscious to herself of her weariness, Mrs. Weldon was exhibiting manifest symptoms of lassitude, and it was only Dick's moral energy and sense of duty that kept him from succumbing to the prevailing dejection. About 4 o'clock, Tom noticed something lying on the grass, and stooping down he picked up a kind of knife. It was of peculiar shape, being very wide and flat in the blade, while its handle, which was of ivory, was ornamented with a good deal of clumsy carving. He carried it at once to Dick, who, when he had scrutinized it, held it up to Harris with the remark, "There must be natives not far off." "Quite right, my young friend. The hacienda must be a very few miles away. But yet, he hesitated. "You don't mean that you are not sure of your way," said Dick sharply. "Not exactly that," replied Harris. "Yet in taking this short cut across the forest, I am inclined to think I am a mile or so out of the way. Perhaps I had better walk on a little way and look about me." "No, you do not leave us here," cried Dick firmly. "Not against your will, but remember, I do not undertake to guide you in the dark." "We must spare you the necessity for that. I can answer for it that Mrs. Weldon will raise no objection to spending another night in the open air. We can start off tomorrow morning as early as we like, and if the distance be only what you represent, a few hours will accomplish it easily." "As you please," answered Harris with cold civility. Just then Dingo again burst out into a vehement fit of barking, and it required no small amount of coaxing on Dick's part to make him cease from his noise. It was decided that the halt should be made at once. Mrs. Weldon, as it had been anticipated, urged nothing against it, being preoccupied by her immediate attentions to Jack, who was lying in her arms, suffering from a decided attack of fever. The shelter of a large thicket had just been selected by Dick as a suitable resting place for the night, when Tom, who was assisting in the necessary preparations, suddenly gave a cry of horror. "What is it, Tom?" asked Dick very calmly. Look at these trees. They are spattered with blood. And look here. Here are hands, men's hands, cut off and lying on the ground." "What?" cried Dick, and in an instant was at his side. His presence of mind did not fail him. He whispered, "Hush, Tom, hush, not a word." but it was with a shudder that ran through his veins that he witnessed for himself the mutilated fragments of several human bodies, and saw, lying beside them, some broken forks and some bits of iron chain. The sight of the gory remains made Dingo bark ferociously, and Dick, who was most anxious that Mrs. Weldon's attention should not be called to the discovery, had the greatest difficulty in driving him back. But fortunately the lady's mind was so engrossed with her patient that she did not observe the commotion. Harris stood aloof. There was no one to notice the change that passed over his countenance, but the expression was almost diabolical in its malignity. Poor old Tom himself seemed perfectly spellbound. With his hands clenched, his eyes dilated, and his breast heaving with emotion, he kept repeating without anything like coherence the words, "Forks! Chains! Forks! Long ago! Remember! Too well! Chains!" "For Mrs. Weldon's sake, Tom, hold your tongue," Dick implored him. Tom, however, was full with some remembrance of the past. He continued to repeat, "Long ago, forks, chains," until Dick led him out of hearing. A fresh halting pace was chosen a short distance further on, and supper was prepared. But the meal was left almost untasted, not so much that hunger had been overcome by fatigue, but because the indefinable feeling of uneasiness that had taken possession of them all had entirely destroyed all appetite. Gradually the night became very dark. The sky was covered with heavy storm clouds, and on the western horizon flashes of summer lightning now and then glimmered through the trees. The air was perfectly still, not a leaf stirred, and the atmosphere seemed so charged with electricity as to be incapable of transmitting sound of any kind. Dick himself, with Austin and Bat in attendance, remained on guard, all of them eagerly straining both eye and ear to catch any light or sound that might disturb the silence and obscurity. Old Tom, with his head sunk upon his breast, sat motionless, as if in a trance. He was gloomily revolving the awakened memories of the past. Mrs. Weldon was engaged with her sick child. Scarcely one of the party was really asleep, except indeed it might be Cousin Benedict, whose reasoning faculties were not of any order to carry him forwards into any future contingencies. Midnight was still an hour in advance, when the dull air seemed filled with a deep and prolonged roar, mingled with a peculiar kind of vibration. Tom started to his feet. A fresh recollection of his early days had struck him. "A lion! A lion!" he shouted. In vain Dick tried to repress him, but he repeated, "A lion! A lion!" Dick Sands seized his cutlass, and unable any longer to control his wrath, he rushed to the spot where he had left Harris lying. The man was gone, and his horse with him. All the suspicions that had been so long pent up within Dick's mind now shaped themselves into actual reality. A flood of light had broken in upon him. Now he was convinced, only too certainly, that it was not the coast of America at all upon which the schooner had been cast ashore. It was not Easter Island that had been sighted far away in the west. The compass had completely deceived him. He was satisfied now that the strong currents had carried them quite round Cape Horn, and that they were really entered the Atlantic. No wonder that Quinquinas, Caoutchouc, and other South American products had failed to be seen. This was neither the Bolivian Pampas nor the Plateau of Atacama. There were giraffes, not ostriches, that had vanished down the glade. There were elephants that had trodden down the underwood. There were hippopotamuses that were lurking by the river. It was indeed that dreaded tsetse fly that Cousin Benedict had so triumphantly discovered, and last of all, it was a lion's roar that had disturbed the silence of the forest. That chain, that knife, those forks, were unquestionably the instruments of slave dealers. And what could those mutilated hands be except the relics of their ill-fated victims? Harris and Negoro must be in a conspiracy. It was with terrible anguish that Dick gnashed his teeth and muttered, "Yes, it is true, we are in Africa, in Equatorial Africa, in the land of slavery, in the very haunt of slave drivers." End of part the first, chapter 18. Recording by Alexi Talander, Davis, California. www.alexitalander.com. Part the second, chapter 1 of Dick Sands, the Boy Captain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Alexi Talander, Davis, California. Dick Sands, the Boy Captain, by Jules Verne, translated by Ellen E. Frewer. Part the second, chapter 1, The Dark Continent. The slave trade is an expression that ought never to have found its way into any human language. After being long practiced at a large profit by European nations as had possessions beyond the seas, this abominable traffic has now for many years been ostensibly forbidden, yet even in the enlightenment of this 19th century it is still largely carried out on, especially in Central America, inasmuch as there are several states, professedly Christian, whose signatures have never been affixed to the deed of abolition. Incredible as it should seem, this barter of human beings still exists, and for the due comprehension of the second part of Dick Sands' story, it must be borne in mind that for the purpose of supplying certain colonies with slaves, there continue to be prosecuted such barbarous manhunts as threatens almost to lay waste an entire continent with blood, fire, and pillage. The nefarious traffic as far as regards Negroes does not appear to have arisen until the 15th century. The following are said to be the circumstances under which it had its origin. After being banished from Spain, the Mussulmans crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and took refuge upon the shores of Africa. But the Portuguese, who then occupied that portion of the coast, persecuted the fugitives with the utmost severity, and having captured them in large numbers, sent them as prisoners into Portugal. They were thus the first nucleus of any African slaves that entered Western Europe since the commencement of the Christian era. The majority, however, of these Mussulmans were members of wealthy families, who were prepared to pay almost any amount of money for their release. But no ransom was exorbitant enough to tempt the Portuguese to surrender them. More precious than gold were the strong arms that should work the resources of their young and rising colonies. Thus balked in their purpose of effecting a direct ransom of their captured slaves, the Mussulman families next submitted a proposition for exchanging them for a larger number of African Negroes, whom it would be quite easy to procure. The Portuguese, to whom the proposal was in every way advantageous, eagerly accepted the offer, and in this way the slave trade was originated in Europe. By the end of the 16th century, this odious traffic had become permanently established. In principle, it contained nothing repugnant to the semi-barbarous thought and customs then existing. All the great states recognized it as the most effectual means of colonizing the islands of the New World, especially slaves of Negro blood, well acclimatized to tropical heat, were able to survive where white men must have perished by thousands. The transport of slaves to the American colonies was consequently regularly effected by vessels specially built for that purpose, and large depots for this branch of commerce were established at various points of the African coast. The goods cost comparatively little in production, and the profits were enormous. Yet, after all, however indispensable it might be to complete the foundation of the transatlantic colonies, there was nothing to justify the shameful barter of human flesh and blood, and the voice of philanthropy began to be heard in protestation, calling upon all European governments, in the name of mercy and common humanity, to decree the abolition of the trade at once. In 1751, the Quakers put themselves at the head of the abolitionist movement in North America, that very land where, 100 years later, the War of Secession burst forth, in which the question of slavery bore the most conspicuous part. Several of the northern states, Virginia, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, prohibited the trade, liberating the slaves, in spite of the cost, who had been imported into their territories. The campaign thus commenced was not limited to a few provinces of the New World. On this side of the Atlantic, too, the partisans of slavery were subject to a vigorous attack. England and France led the van and energetically beat up recruits to serve the righteous cause. "Let us lose our colonies rather than sacrifice our principles," was the magnanimous watchword that resounded throughout Europe. And notwithstanding the vast political and commercial interests involved in the question, it did not go forth in vain. A living impulse had been communicated to the liberation movement. In 1807, England formally prohibited the slave trade in her colonies, France following her example in 1814. The two great nations then entered upon a treaty on the subject, which was confirmed by Napoleon during the Hundred Days. Hitherto, however, the declaration was purely theoretical. Slave ships continued to ply their illicit trade, discharging their living cargo at many a colonial port. It was evident that more resolute and practical measures must be taken to impress the enormity. Accordingly, the United States in 1820 and Great Britain in 1824 declared the slave trade to be an act of piracy and its perpetrators to be punishable with death. France soon gave in to her adherence to the new treaty, but the southern states of America and the Spanish and Portuguese, not having signed the act of abolition, continued the importation of slaves at a great profit, and this in defiance of the recognized reciprocal right of visitation to verify the flags of suspected ships. But although the slave trade by these measures was in a considerable measure reduced, it continued to exist. New slaves were not allowed, but the old ones did not recover their liberty. England was now the first to set a noble example. On the 14th of May, 1833, an act of Parliament, by a munificent vote of millions of pounds, emancipated all the Negroes in the British colonies, and in August 1838, 670,000 slaves were declared free men. 10 years later, in 1848, the French Republic liberated the slaves in her colonies, to the number of 260,000. And in 1859, the war which broke out between the Federals and Confederates in the United States finished the work of emancipation by extending it to the whole of North America. Thus, three great powers have accomplished their task of humanity, and at the present time the slave trade is carried on only for the advantage of the Spanish and Portuguese colonies, or to supply the requirements of the Turkish or Arab populations of the East. Brazil, although she has not emancipated her former slaves, does not receive any new, and all Negro children are pronounced freeborn. In contrast, however, to all this, it is not to be concealed that in the interior of Africa, as a result of wars between chieftains waged for the sole object of making captives, entire tribes are often reduced to slavery and are carried off in caravans in two opposite directions, some westwards to the Portuguese colony of Angola, others eastwards to Mozambique. Of these miserable creatures, of whom a very small proportion ever reach their destination, some are dispatched to Cuba or Madagascar, others to the Arab or Turkish provinces of Asia, to Mecca or Muscat. The French and English cruisers have practically very little power to control the iniquitous proceedings, because the extent of coast to be watched is so large that a strict and adequate surveillance cannot be maintained. The extent of the odious export is very considerable. No less than 24,000 slaves annually reach the coast, a number that hardly represents a tenth part of those who are massacred or otherwise perished by a deplorable end. After the frightful butcheries, the fields lie devastated, the spoiling villages are void of inhabitants, the rivers reek with bleeding corpses, and wild beasts take undisputed possession of the soil. Livingstone, upon returning to the district immediately after one of these ruthless raids, said that he could never have recognized it for the same that he had visited only a few months previously, and all other travellers, Grant, Speck, Burton, Cameron, Stanley, described the wooded plateau of Central Africa as the principal theatre of the barbarous warfare between chief and chief. In the region of the Great Lakes, throughout the vast district which feeds the market of Zanzibar in Bornu and Fezzan, further south on the banks of the Nyasa and the Zambezi, further west in the districts of the Upper Zaire, just traversed by the intrepid Stanley, everywhere there is the recurrence of the same scenes of ruin, slaughter, and devastation. Ever and again the question seems to be forced upon the mind whether slavery is not to end in the entire annihilation of the Negro race, so that, like the Australian tribes of South Holland, it will become extinct. Who can doubt that the day must dawn which will herald the closing of the markets in the Spanish and Portuguese colonies, a day when civilized nations shall no longer tolerate the perpetration of this barbarous wrong? It is hardly too much to say that another year ought to witness the emancipation of every slave in the possession of Christian states. It seems only too likely that for years to come the Mussulman nations will continue to depopulate the continent of Africa. To them is due the chief emigration of the natives, who, torn from their promises, are sent to the eastern coast in numbers that exceed 40,000 annually. Long before the Egyptian expedition, the natives of Sennar were sold to the natives of Darfur, and vice versa, and even Napoleon Bonaparte purchased a considerable number of Negroes, whom he organized into regiments after the fashion of Mamelukes. And altogether it may be affirmed that although 4/5 of the present century have passed away, slave traffic in Africa has been increased rather than diminished. The truth is that Islamism really nurtures the slave trade. In Muslim provinces, the black slave has taken the place of the white slave of former times. Dealers of the most questionable character bear their part in the execrable business, bringing a supplementary population to races which, unregenerated by their own labor, would otherwise diminish and ultimately disappear. As in the time of Bonaparte, these slaves often become soldiers. On the Upper Niger, for instance, they still form half the army of certain chieftains, under circumstances in which their lot is hardly, if at all, inferior to that of free men. Elsewhere, where the slave is not a soldier, he counts merely as current coin, and in Bornu and even in Egypt we are told by William Lejeune, an eyewitness, that officers and other functionaries have received their pay in this form. Such, then, appears to be the present actual condition of the slave trade, and it is stern justice that compels the additional statement that there are representatives of certain great European powers who still favor the unholy traffic with an indulgent connivance, and whilst cruisers are watching the coast of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean, kidnapping goes on regularly in the interior. Caravans pass along under the very eyes of certain officials, and massacres are perpetrated in which frequently 10 Negroes are sacrificed in the capture of a single slave. It was the knowledge, more or less complete, of all this that wrung from Dick Sands his bitter and heart-rending cry, "We are in Africa, in the very haunt of slave drivers." Too true it was that he found himself and his companions in a land fraught with such frightful peril. He could only tremble when he wondered on what part of the fatal continent the pilgrim had stranded. Evidently it was at some point of the west coast, and he had every reason to fear that it was on the shores of Angola, the rendezvous for all the caravans that journey in that portion of Africa. His conjecture was correct. He really was in the very country that a few years later, and with gigantic effort, was to be traversed by Cameron in the south and Stanley in the north. Of the vast territory with its three provinces, Congo, Angola, and Benguela, little was then known except the coast. It extends from the Zaire on the north to the Norse on the south, and its chief towns are the ports of Benguela and St. Paul de Luanda. the capital of the colony, which is a dependency of the kingdom of Portugal. The interior of the country had been almost entirely unexplored. Very few were the travellers who had cared to venture far inland, for an unhealthy climate, a hot, damp soil conducive to fever, a permanent warfare between the native tribes, some of which are cannibals, and the ill feeling of the slave dealers against any stranger who might endeavour to discover the secrets of their infamous craft, all combined to render the region one of the most hazardous in the whole of equatorial Africa. It was in 1816 that Tucky ascended the Congo as far as the Yalala Falls, at distance not exceeding 203 miles, but the journey was too short to give an accurate idea of the interior of the country, and moreover cost the lives of nearly all the officers and scientific men connected with the expedition. 37 years afterwards, Dr. Livingstone had advanced from the Cape of Good Hope to the upper Zambezi. Thence, with a fearlessness hitherto unrivalled, he crossed the Coango, an affluent of the Congo, and after having traversed the continent from the extreme south to the east, he reached St. Paul de Luanda on the 31st of May, 1854, the first explorer of the unknown portions of the great Portuguese colony. 18 years elapsed, and two other bold travellers crossed the entire continent from east to west, and after encountering unparalleled difficulties, emerged, the one to the south, the other to the north. The first of these was Verney Lovett Cameron, a lieutenant in the British Navy. In 1872, when serious doubts were entertained as to the safety of the expedition sent out under Stanley to the relief of Livingstone in the Great Lake District, Lieutenant Cameron volunteered to go out in search of the noble missionary explorer. His offer was accepted, and accompanied by Dr. Dillon, Lieutenant Cecil Murphy, and Robert Moffat, a nephew of Livingstone, he started from Zanzibar. Having passed through Ugogo, he met Livingstone's corpse, which was being borne to the eastern coast by his faithful followers. Unshaken in his resolve to make his way right across the continent, Cameron still pushed onwards to the west. He passed through Unyanyembe and Uganda, and reached Kawele, where he secured all Livingstone's papers. After exploring Lake Tanganyika, he crossed the mountains of Bambare, and finding himself unable to descend the course of Lualaba, he traversed the provinces devastated and depopulated by war and the slave trade, Kilemba, Urua, the sources of the Lomami, Ulanda, and Lovale, and having crossed the Kwanza, he sighted the Atlantic and reached the port of St. Philip de Benguela, after a journey that had occupied 3 years and 5 months. Cameron's two companions, Dr. Dillon and Robert Moffat, both succumbed to the hardships of the expedition. The intrepid Englishman was soon to be followed into the field by an American, Mr. Henry Moreland Stanley. It is universally known how the undaunted correspondent of the New York Herald, having been dispatched in search of Livingstone, found the veteran missionary at Ujiji, on the borders of Lake Tanganyika, on the 31st of October, 1871. But what he had undertaken in the course of humanity, Stanley longed to continue in the interests of science, his prime object being to make a thorough investigation of the Dualaba, of which, in his first expedition, he had only been able to get a partial and imperfect survey. Accordingly, whilst Cameron was still deep in the provinces of Central Africa, Stanley started from Bagamoyo in November 1874. 21 months later, he had quitted Ujiji, which had been decimated by smallpox, and in 74 days accomplished the passage of the lake and reached Nyangwe, a great slave market previously visited both by Livingstone and Cameron. He was also present at some of the horrible razzias perpetrated by the officers of the Sultan of Zanzibar in the districts of Marunzu and Manyuema. In order to be in a position to descend the Lualaba to its very mouth, Stanley engaged at Nyangwe 140 porters and 19 boats. Difficulties arose from the very outset, and not only had he to contend with the cannibals of Ugu Su, but in order to avoid many unnavigable cataracts, he had to convey his boats many miles by land. Near the equator, just at the point where the Lualaba turns north-northwest, Stanley's little convoy was attacked by a fleet of boats, manned by several hundred natives, whom, however, he succeeded in putting to flight. Nothing daunted, the resolute American pushed on to latitude 20 degrees north, and ascertained beyond room for doubt that the Lualaba was really the upper Zaire or Congo, and that, by following its course, he should come directly to the sea. Beset with many perils was the way. Stanley was in almost daily collision with the various tribes upon the river banks. On the 3rd of June, 1877, he lost one of his companions, Frank Pocock, at the passage of the cataracts of Masasa, and on the 18th of July he was himself carried in his boat into the Mbelo Falls, and escaped by little short of a miracle. On the 6th of August the daring adventurer arrived at the village of Nisanda, only 4 days from the sea. 2 days later he received a supply of provisions that had been sent by two Mboma merchants to Banza Mbuku, the little coast town where, after a journey of 2 years and 9 months, fraught with every kind of hardship and privation, he completed his transit of the mighty continent. His toil told, at least temporarily, upon his years, but he had the grand satisfaction of knowing that he had traced the whole course of the Lualaba, and had ascertained beyond reach of question that as the Nile is the great artery of the north, and the Zambezi of the east, so Africa possesses in the west a third great river, which, in a course of no less than 2,900 miles, under the names of the Lualaba, Zaire, and Congo, unites the Lake District with the Atlantic Ocean. In 1873, however, the date at which the Pilgrim founded upon the coast, very little was known of the province of Angola, except that it was the scene of the western slave trade, of which the markets of Bihe, Kasanga, and Kasindi were the chief centres. This was the country in which Dick Sands now found himself, 100 miles from shore, in charge of a lady exhausted with fatigue and anxiety, a half-dying child, and a band of negroes who would be most tempting bait to the slave driver. His last illusion was completely dispelled. He had no longer the faintest hope that he was in America, that land where little was to be dreaded from either native, wild beast, or climate. He could no more cherish the fond impression that he might be in the pleasant region between the Cordilleras and the coast, where villages are numerous and missions afford hospital shelter to every traveller. Far, far away were those provinces of Bolivia and Peru, to which, unless a criminal hand had interposed, the Pilgrim would certainly have sped her way. No, too truly this was the terrible province of Angola, and worse than all, not the district near the coast, under the surveillance of the Portuguese authorities, but the interior of the country, traversed only by slave caravans, driven under the lash of the Havildars. Limited in one sense was the knowledge that Dick Sands possessed of this land of horrors, but he had read the accounts that had been given by the missionaries of the 16th and 17th centuries, by the Portuguese traders who frequented the route from St. Paul to Luanda, by San Salvador to the Zaire, as well as by Dr. Livingstone in his travels in 1853, and consequently he knew enough to awaken immediate and complete despair in any spirit less indomitable than his own. Anyhow, his position was truly appalling. End of Part the Second, Chapter 1. Recording by Alex Hetelander, Davis, California. www.alexhetelander.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.